So first of all, thank you so much for listening in English. As you can imagine, with a name like Solitaire, my parents did not teach me French. This was okay. And my Dutch, not so good. When I was travelling here this morning on the Eurostar, I was very stressed. Yesterday, we had a session in San Francisco for my company, and it was happening whilst I was asleep, and I was stressed about how it might have gone. And I got to the Eurostar, and the Eurostar is stressful. And I got on the Eurostar. And as I was on my way here thinking about my slides and what I wanted to talk about, I saw the beautiful wind turbines out of the window. And I was thinking about how when I was a girl, this would be like science fiction, that there would be wind turbines, that I would just be passing on a train. It was almost like a movie. And then I got here to Brussels, and I got off at Midi Station, and I walked from the Eurostar to here. That's where you go, ooh, it's a long walk. Thank you very much. And as I was walking through parts of Belgium and parts of Brussels that perhaps tourists don't walk through very often, the walk from Midi Station to here, and I passed a school of children playing, and I passed a college that had a ceramics fair that was going outside of it, I suddenly started thinking that life is good. Life is good. Even though most of the time when we listen on the TV or we look on our news app, life does not feel good. Life is good. And I'm here to talk to you a little bit about sustainability, social, environmental, and governance. I'm here to talk to you and actually try to share some tools and some tactics that you can use. But I'm also here because I just love engaging with people who want to have this conversation. And it is my incredible, massive privilege to have the opportunity to travel around the world. And as I look out over you, I've also had the opportunity to look out over audiences like this in Brazil and Colombia, in India, in China, in Japan. You are part of a huge community of people who give a shit. It's cute when British people swear. It's okay. It's like the Queen. A huge community of people who actually want to turn up and be part of this conversation. So I want to think a little bit about rethinking how we impact the world. And I want to start with the fact that we have this world that we're standing on right now, where we have this choice. On one side, we have an extractive and exploitative economy. We have an economy where extracting resources and exploiting people is built in. And the reason why it's built into our economy is that this economy was designed by a whole set of British gentlemen in the 18th century. This economy was designed by people who lived on a gigantic planet, much of which had never been explored by them. On a planet where the idea that there might be a limit to growth, a planet where perhaps there might not be unlimited resources, hadn't even occurred to them. This economy was designed by people who had never seen that beautiful image of Earthrise, that little blue pebble in space. Let's be honest, this economy was also designed by a group of men who did not think that women or people with different colour skin could ever come up with a good idea. And actually, in many ways, I'm grateful for them for designing the capitalist economy of which we're a part. Because it has done extraordinary things in lifting people out of poverty, in generating incredible levels of education and freedom, in allowing a woman to stand on a stage and make a speech. It's not everything about this economy has been a problem, except for the fact that now, in 2026, we know that we will go past 1.5 degrees of global warming. In 2026, we know that, sadly, we are acting as if we were an asteroid on the planet in terms of the number of species that are lost. And we now know in 2026 that more human beings, in terms of numbers, live in slavery today than at the height of the transatlantic American slave trade. So, we have an economy that has generated incredible gifts and a lot of problems. And so I believe that we now stand on the point where we are facing a solutions economy. And many of you in this room, and definitely the people I just saw up here, those six incredible leaders, are part of this solutions economy. An economy where growth, value, wealth will be generated by solving the problems of the previous economy. I was just thinking, talking to gentlemen from Out of Use, where there is a cost to waste, but an income from recycling. So this is where we stand. We stand. Which way are we going to go? Are we going to stay in the extractive and exploitative economy, or are we going to move to this new solutions economy? Well, I've been doing this work for a long time, almost 30 years. So let's go back in time. So this is me going back in time. Am I going the right way? I am going the right way. I'm getting thinner and thinner as I walk back, and my hair is getting longer and longer, and like my face is more innocent in what it's seen in the world. So go back to the 1990s. How we planned for action to be taken in the 1990s, how we planned for action to be taken on climate change, on human rights, on waste and renewables, on all of the social, environmental, and economic issues. And I use climate change here as a stand-in for all of those issues, because we have more data on climate than we have on everything else. But when I say climate here, I mean all of those social and environmental issues. When we stand here, we thought that the world would improve on these topics a little bit at a time, that there would be this small incremental improvement in action over time. Every year we'd have a little bit more renewable energy. Every year a few more people would be educated. Every year a few more mountains of waste would be recycled. That's not how it happened. We are not on track for this. We are very, very behind. And the problem with incremental change is that when you do incremental change, if you get behind by 1 year, you then have 2 years you have to pick up. And if you get it, essentially, incremental failure compounds exponentially. And so you end up in this situation where you're so far behind, how could you ever catch up? And that's how I think many of us feel today. We're like, is this actually even possible? We're so far behind. Can we ever catch up? Thankfully, humanity has never changed like this. None of the enormous changes in our history has ever happened neatly and nicely, as if it was on an accountant's spreadsheet of improvement. How society actually changes is called punctuated equilibrium. Punctuated equilibrium. I'm testing your English now with some of this terminology. So I'll explain the two words. So equilibrium. Everything stays the same. All of the systems and the power and the money stays the same. That actually, even when some of those systems start to not work, even when we realise that the rules laid down by Adam Smith and the early economists didn't take into account resource constraints, even when we understand that GDP also includes people getting cancer as a positive thing for GDP, even when we realise that these systems don't work, we have equilibrium, and human beings like equilibrium. We hate change. Change is difficult and stressful and constant. We like things to be the same. We like to know that tomorrow, overall might look a bit like today, because we can plan, we can have children, we can grow families, we can trust if everything stays the same. And so we hold on to this equilibrium until it's far past the point when we should change. The pressure is built up, and then we do all the change at once. This is the punch. And then we go to another equilibrium. Punctuated equilibrium. It's how social views change, how we can have a social view when we were younger around equal marriage that then by the time we're older feels like it's completely different. It's how technology gets adopted. These S curves are how society changes. And that's fantastic, because that's how we're going to change on these social and environmental issues. So, don't move that on. So if this is how we thought all of this change was going to happen, it's utterly impossible to manage that level of change constantly over that period of time. What we'll do is nothing, or in perfect English, sod all, until we have to do it all at once. And that's where we are about now. We've begun to feel some of this change. Even here, we were talking about what it was like years ago versus what it's like now. And we were talking about the fact that actually, you know, now there seems to be something which is being picked up and we're beginning to go up. One thing to say, though, at this point, is a few years ago, I would talk about the fact that it's not guaranteed that we would go up. That systems and power and money might prevent us from getting up that line. But I would say, but it's okay, because there's no evil person sitting in a castle going, ha ha ha, let's make the world worse for everyone. That was a few years ago. Now, that maybe there are one or two Americans. Now, I jest. This is systems. This is sociology. This is how the world changes. And, oh, I seem to have lost my picture. Oh. We particularly see that exponential curve in energy. I am very lucky. I get to spend time in places like China. Last year, in 2025, China bought online the same amount of renewable energy, the equivalent amount of renewable energy, they turned on the same amount of renewable energy as the entirety of Europe's consumption in 1 year. So I've got to interview people like Bill Gates for my book. And then recently, Bill Gates was saying that he's not as concerned about climate change anymore. That's not because he doesn't think that climate change matters. It's because he thinks we're already on the road to fixing it. That the transformation, that the capital spent, that the insurance, that the risk. In the UK, the UK government recently opened up some drilling licenses in the North Sea. Nobody bought them. Because the capex spend to get oil out of the North Sea, we got all the easy oil. It's now quite difficult to get oil out of the North Sea. The capex spend is just so significant. The insurance is just so significant. The energy return on investment, the margin of being unsustainable is no longer good enough. And I think we should be able to talk about words like margin when we're talking about sustainability. We should be able to talk about the fact that these curves have winners and losers. That there are companies that will do spectacularly as an S curve goes up, and there'll be companies that lose out. And that's okay, because that's how capitalism works. Now, we don't see this on all things, but we're particularly beginning to see it on technological adoption. I'm just going to skip through a few of these slides quite quickly because in terms of time. Sorry, some of these are just sort of some information about how some of this works. Because what I want to get to is how do we actually talk about some of this? Sorry, this is, here we go. So when we're trying to go up that curve and make that transition, when we're trying to make this solutions economy be much, much bigger, how do we talk about it? because I think it was Vanessa that mentioned that we're currently in a bit of a downwave. My organisation, Futera, we actually measured the upwaves and the downwaves on social, environmental and governance issues going back to 1960. That's even before I was working in this. And if you go back to 1960 and track the media coverage of human rights, of climate change and global warming, if you go back to 1960 and track the media coverage of recycling and social good, if you track the media coverage of renewable energy, you will see these waves. Sometimes the media can talk about nothing else, and sometimes the media won't talk about it at all. In just before, in 2006 and 2007, we were having a big wave up, and then something happened in 2008. A few people are laughing. Some of the young people are like, what? You had to be there. In 2008, with the financial crash, suddenly all of the headlines were saying, business can't afford to be good. CSR is dead. All of the coverage suddenly dropped off, and nobody wanted to talk about doing this again. And then it began to climb again and climb back up. And suddenly in 2018 and 2019 and 2020, we had Black Lives Matter and Me Too and Fridays for Future and purposeful brands. And we even had the CEO of BlackRock telling us that we actually had to change and that purpose was central. And the Gen Zs were coming and the Gen Zs cared about this more than anything else. And then at the end of the pandemic, everybody was sick of being good. And suddenly we're in a downwave. But if you track those waves, you realize that although they actually are influenced by, those waves influenced by economics, cost of living, those upwards and downwards waves are influenced by politics. What they're mainly influenced by is media interest and the media cycle. The media cycle sometimes goes to the fact that everybody's good and we want to save the world. And then sometimes the media cycle goes to, no, it's all tradwives and incels. And it goes backwards and forwards. And we are due for the next upwave to start coming in 2027. And I'm already beginning to feel some of it in terms of what I see in social media, what I see outside of the traditional media. I begin to see a little bit of a build. But we have to decide within this community, the people who work on these topics, the businesses, is what do we want the next upwave to be about? Because the past upwave was a lot of compliance. CSRD, CSDDD, there's a, you know, SBTI, ISA, like there was a lot of management of sustainability. In fact, IBM did an analysis where they found out that companies were spending more on reporting than on doing sustainability. ESG, which was supposed to be a terminology just for investors, suddenly started being something that all of us could do. What a terrible term as well, ESG. Eggs, sausage, and greens. Do we want that to be what we focus on when we go up the next wave up? Once we start having regulators and consumers start being interested in talking about this again, do we want that to be the focus? Or do we want entrepreneurial sustainability, making money out of saving the world, to be the next wave up? Because the wave about compliance, the thing that annoys me about compliance, is that compliance assumes you're bad. It assumes that your impact as a business is negative. It assumes that what we need business to do is do less bad. It doesn't include any space for doing more good. Now, I love the activist and the NGO community. I'm part of them. Many of them are my clients. Their job in activism and in the NGOs is to point out the problems, and they're very good at it. Many of them are like an early warning system where they identify some of the problems before they've even become giant problems. But their job is not to solve it. Nor, interestingly, in many cases, is it government's job to solve it. It's businesses' job to create the solutions, to monetize those solutions, and to scale them within the system that we have. There's a reason why this says solutions economy and not solutions society or solutions government. It's because most of the solutions, such as renewables that I showed earlier, it's not governments that have giant manufacturing bases for solar panels. It's not governments that are actually going offshore and building these deep cores of wind turbines that can come up. It's business. And it's businesses, many of them making a great deal of money, a huge margin out of doing so. So when we're going to go up this side, we need to talk more about the entrepreneurial opportunity than the managerial responsibility. We're also going to have to start talking to the public and to our staff differently. I think it was very interesting, Natalie's point about staff and colleagues and how important it is for them to understand what's going on here. And when the public and our consumers hear about sustainability, they hear about the morality of it. And there is a huge, huge moral reason for taking action on this. There's huge issues around equity, and climate change is terrifying. And of course, we all want to leave a world that's better for our children. But there's a giant secret that we don't tell the public, we don't tell our consumers, a big secret that we're keeping from the world, which is the huge benefits of sustainability to us as individuals, the benefits to our lifestyle. When Futera, my company, we did an analysis of the most awarded sustainability campaigns, the advertising campaigns that had won the most awards. Really, really bad. These campaigns that had won Cannes Awards, and they had won Ad Net Zero Awards, and they'd won DNAD Awards. All of your marketing teams desperately want to win those awards. No. But when we analysed these sustainability campaigns, these campaigns about CSR, these campaigns about purpose, these campaigns about social good, we identified that less than 20% of them mentioned any benefit to the consumer from this work that the company was doing. None of them made you want to buy. They made you want to cry because they had beautiful soundtracks and incredible, amazing videography. And they were like, that made me feel so powerful. Thank you. But I can't remember the brand name and I don't know what they sell. Not marketing. The previous era of talking about sustainability to consumers was corporate comms with a marketing budget. And we can't keep doing that, because if we really want sustainability to sell, we're going to have to actually sell it and get our hands dirty in actually talking like capitalists with a product to sell. Now, there's three main ways to organise those benefits. Functional benefits. So functional benefits are, is there any way in which our product saves the consumer money? Does it make it easier for her to use? Does it improve quality? We know what a functional benefit is. I was thinking about the Snappies, and I was going, where are the, you know, is this cheaper for the people? Is this easier to use? Is it? They go, no, no. But it's okay. I have other benefits. Second set of benefits, because of course consumers say they care about value for money, and then the consumer spends 250 euros on a pair of trainers. So it's not just value for money that consumers care about. Consumers also care about emotional benefits. So does this sustainability solution make me feel good about myself? Does it make me feel like an incredible person? Does it give me a sense of self-worth? Does it make me feel that I'm connected? Like, one of the things which drives me crazy is when companies talk about themselves to consumers, as if the company is the hero telling the consumer what they're doing on sustainability. The consumer does not give a shit what you're doing on sustainability. She cares about whether you're making her feel good, whether you're telling her that she's an amazing person for doing and buying this product. And the third thing that consumers value is social value. So are you helping her talk about what an amazing person she is? Are you giving her a way to virtue signal from buying your product and show the world how amazing she is? Now, when we start thinking about these benefits, I'll give you an example of how you can sell a benefit to consumer. One of my clients is Chanel Fragrance and Beauty. Chanel makes some of the most expensive moisturizer in the world. I went and I did a session at Chanel, and they gave me a giant, giant hunk of glass with a small amount of product inside it that cost 650 euros. Can you tell? I always wanted to just give me the money. 650, I had to get at home on the Eurostar, it was really heavy. 650 euros worth. So this is, when people buy luxury products, they're not looking for sustainability. Luxury is something I already feel guilty about. No one spends 650 euros on moisturizer without feeling a bit guilty about it. I hope, maybe. And so how can you talk to sustainability? Well, the sustainability team actually created a refill for this product. Very difficult to get luxury consumers to do a refill because of sustainability. But crucially, they made the refill beautiful. It's a beautiful little pot, and it has its own top that you can screw on, screw out, and you can take it out. And they sold it to the consumer on the fact that you can travel with your expensive moisturizer now. No one can travel with this thing that looks like an objet d'art, but you can travel with the small pot out. Now, those of you who understand business will like this bit. This giant hunk of glass with the product inside it costs 650 euros. The refill costs 550 euros. Want to talk about margin? So this has become one of their best-selling products. Consumers love it. They love the fact that they can have the indulgent thing on their sideboard if that's what they want, and they love the fact that they can have the product that they travel around with. This is selling a benefit to the consumer from refills. Here in Europe, we're going to have to go to refills. Like, the EU has been very clear about the level of packaging reduction that needs to happen, and everybody's going, oh, how are we going to get consumers to do it? And then one of the least sustainable products in the world has managed to do it by selling a benefit to the consumer that you can travel. Now, sit down with all of the sustainability innovations you've done and try to list out every single functional, emotional, and social benefit that there might be to the consumer. And if you can't find any, then stop talking to the consumer about sustainability. Because those are the benefits, and John was talking about Americans caring about making money. There's something we could learn from that in terms of sustainability. Because asking the consumer to be a moral actor, asking the consumer to make choices based on morality, keeps your audience extremely small. Whereas talking to the consumer about the benefits there are to her from sustainability, you can still talk about sustainability, but you're talking about this product is better value for money because it's sustainable. This product is higher quality because we treat our supply chain right, and everybody who works in our supply chain is well-fed and cares about quality. This product makes you look like an amazing person because it's recycled and it's got a little tag on it that you can show the fact that you're wearing vintage recycled. Finding those benefits to the consumer. And by the way, this doesn't just work if you're in B2C. It works even better if you're in B2B, because finding those benefits to your customer can be more extreme. And I wanted to put this out there because sometimes sustainability rots business people's brains. It's like suddenly we start thinking like Greenpeace and that we have to do the job of the activists or do the job of the government. Mm-mm. We need to do our job. And our job as businesses is to create the solutions to the problems that the previous economy created, to monetize and to scale those solutions. Because if we can do that by focusing on the benefits and thinking about how we go up that S-curve, then we will be doing our job as businesses. And our job as businesses is to make a ton of money out of saving the world. Now, I stand up here as a high priestess of sustainability who has dedicated her life to this. I have master's degrees in this. I advise the UN on this. I advise great big companies. I advise prime ministers. I used to advise presidents. I don't do that so much now. I'm not even sure if I'm going to be allowed in the country again. But, and the advice that I give to business is always to do what business is fantastic at, which is to find, identify, and meet needs. And as we live in this world where climate change is beginning to affect our everyday lives, where equity and social issues are leading to division in society that's causing great instability and fear and anxiety, the public have real needs that they need fulfilling on environmental and social issues. They need people to invent solutions that solve their problems and to show them the benefits that they're going to get to do so. And if we manage to do that, if we manage to, as business people, just like these examples that I've heard this afternoon, this evening, if we manage to do that, then we will be vastly more impactful than perhaps any other sector in society is. If we don't, if we stay focused in the extractive and exploitative economy that was designed by a group of British chaps 250 years ago, then we deserve what we're going to get, because it means we are not entrepreneurs. It means we are just mimics of the business that came before us. We're merely mimicking and repeating what other people before us have invented. And I believe that we are much, much smarter than that. So thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to come and say a few words to me. Love a bit of music. Do we have time for a question?
Excuse me?
Do we have time for a question?
We always have time for questions. I'm just going to take the microphone, and I'm going to dive into the audience. If you have a question for... Yeah, we have one. I'm going to sprint. You can ask the question in Dutch, in French, or in English. Other languages are excluded.
In Mandarin.
First, state your name and maybe also the company that you work for, and then you can ask your question. Go ahead.
With pleasure. My name is Alexandre Vivier. I'm working for the Belgian Railways, SNCB. So I'm particularly happy you enjoyed your train journey earlier today. question about your punctuated equilibrium.
Punctuated equilibrium.
Exactly. So how do you reconcile this with infrastructure and the fact that it takes time, a bit more than for perfume?
Yeah.
And also with the fact that there is the concept of global carbon budget and that time is basically running out.
Yes. So I'll do the second half first. So in terms of time is running out, time has been running out the entire time I've worked in this sector. So I've worked in sustainability for 30 years. I did my master's degree in environmental science in the mid-1990s. Don't tell me if you were born then. And the urgency has always been there, and the urgency remains. We are going to go past 1.5 degrees of global warming. We will probably go to 1.8. But every degree matters. 1.8.5 matters. 1.7.5 matters. So we have a huge urgency to make this transition. I believe that urgency is best served by desire than by fear. Because we've been selling fear on this for a very long time with very slow progress. And the one part of infrastructure where we are genuinely getting an exponential curve on renewable energy, that has not been driven by people being afraid of climate change. That S-curve on renewable energy is being driven by cost. It's being driven by the fact that this is now one of the cheapest forms of energy, and it's distributed, and it doesn't tend to have a Strait of Hormuz involved in distributing it. And so I think that this issue of desiring things can lead to much more rapid infrastructure transformation than all of the sense of urgency and fear. Fear, in my experience, and I've been involved in giant campaigns, and I advise Netflix and Disney on how to incorporate sustainability in their storytelling. I feel that fear should motivate, but often it freezes. Often people just freeze, and everything feels so huge and so impossible that they can't do anything. Whereas desire, the fact that as a nation, in the UK, as a nation, we could be energy independent. We have such a lot of wind. Like, it's really not okay. It's really hard. Like you, no one ever hangs their washing outside in England because it'll be in the neighbour's garden. We have so much wind. That means we could be energy independent many times over. We become a net exporter of energy. That leaves us less vulnerable. It leaves us much wealthier. And it also crucially means that there's no central area that could shut down and have brownouts. That desire leads to faster infrastructure change. I also remind you what I said earlier about going these transformations. I'm as old as the internet. I was born in the 1970s. This is where the first parts of the internet were being laid down. In my lifetime, and I am not that old, in my lifetime, we have transformed how our economies work, utterly transformed how the financial sector works in terms of investments and capital. We've transformed how we communicate with each other and how business works. Not necessarily that Teams is the best thing in the world, but it's how we work. We've transformed how we date and meet our partners. We've transformed everything, and the amount of infrastructure that has taken has been huge. And we've done it in 30 years because we wanted to. So this is, I absolutely believe that this transformation is completely possible. I'm seeing it in places like China and India, where they're building their infrastructure to begin with. They're not having to refurbish. Beginning to see it happen in those places. As I said, China bringing on the same amount of renewable energy in 1 year as the entirety of Europe's consumption. It is possible if you want it. It's probably not possible if you're just doing it because you're scared of the alternative.
One more? Yeah? You feel? Yeah? Yeah?
Oh, okay. There's one of you going, yes, me, yes.
Yeah. One more. English, French, or Dutch? And first, state your name and the company you work for.
Yes, thanks. Thank you, Solita. My name is, My name is Baudouin. I work at EcoShift. First, a preliminary question. Have you ever heard of a British company called Faith in Nature?
Yes. And their not governance. Only do I know them, their products are in my bathroom.
Right. I didn't want to talk about your bathroom.
Too much information. Just to be clear, Faith in Nature makes shampoo, not anything gross.
Right. And they have something very specific, is that they have appointed nature on their board in 2022. Since then, so they have created history. And since then, other companies in other countries and in Belgium, like EcoShift, have appointed nature on the board. And nature is shareholder. Now, my question, when do you think this will become the norm?
It's a great question. I think that in terms of governance, there's many fascinating things happening with governance at the moment. So nature on boards is one of them. The B Corp movement is another. The cooperatives movement, which I think something like almost 5% of people in work in the formal economy in India work for cooperatives. These these different ways of thinking about how governance can work, I think are absolutely going up. I think Nature on the Board is very early in its stages because, of course, Nature on the Board has to be represented by a human on the board. So I think we're still working out how that might work. Please, God, let's not have a similar thing with AI on the board. Let's hold that. Someone literally did suggest that to me the other day, again, should you put chat on the board? It's like, do not, because it'll just tell you all your ideas are brilliant. But Nature on the Board, I think, is one of these examples. Some very large companies have become B Corps now. So Danone is now a B Corp. Apelier is a B Corp. And one of the things which I think people don't understand about what's so radical about the B Corp movement, which is much, much, much bigger than the Nature on Board, is that it protects the business from making decisions that don't meet the balance between shareholders and nature and stakeholders. It doesn't mean that you always have to go with the nature and stakeholders. It just means you can't get bullied by your shareholders. Not that you often get bullied by shareholders. You get bullied by your shareholder representatives, such as hedge fund managers. And so for these very large businesses, by being a B Corp, it means they legally are now able to balance these things out. What we find with the Nature on Board piece is that unless you've made the nature a shareholder and given nature enough shareholding that it actually has a significant enough holding to be able to have voting rights, the Nature on Board doesn't give quite the same protections. So you need to have nature as a shareholder. And I've begun to see that as well. And for example, this has existed for a very long time. The Guardian newspaper, many of you will know the Guardian newspaper in the UK. The Guardian newspaper is owned by a charity, 100%. They're not shareholder owned, they're charity owned. IKEA is owned by the IKEA Foundation. So one of the reasons why when this happens with sustainability, IKEA continues on its sustainability journey because the IKEA Foundation says, no, we are thinking about the long term. Mars is one of my clients. Mars is a fantastic business, still with a family who are thinking about the future generations of their family, the Mars family. People who have Mars as a surname are thinking about their future. So I think that there's a lot of innovation that's going on around this curve. What I would like to see is a little bit more innovation on the other side, a bit more innovation from shareholders in terms of things such as patient capital, and not just companies changing their governance, but shareholders changing their governance as well. Pension funds realizing what on earth is the point as a pension fund of investing for the short term when the whole purpose of your fund is people's future. And what is the point of investing in a way that's going to ruin that future so that the people who end up retiring don't have a world to live in? So I think absolutely we'll see a bell curve around company governance, but I'd really like to see a matching bell curve around investor governance and some real innovation in that space. Over the next 10 or 15 years, we will see one of the biggest transfers of capital between generations that have ever, ever happened. The transfer of capital from the boomer generation. Everyone always skips my generation, the Gen X. We don't get mentioned. From the boomer generation to the millennials and the Gen Zs. I think that's the point where we're going to start to see some very interesting changes in how some of these decisions are taken.
Solitaire. Can I give you a huge high five and a huge round of applause? Ladies and gentlemen, yes. Will you stay here during the reception?
I will stay for a little bit during this reception, but I do have to get on a train first thing tomorrow morning.
At what time? What time do you have a train?
5 a.m.
5 a.m. Okay, so no beers for you tonight. So thank you very much
thank
for this high energy and this huge inspiration.
Can
thank
I
you very
just
much.
Say a moment? Can I just say a massive thank you to FBO Feb and to Time for Society, because Belgium's awesome, and I will take any request to come and speak here. This is a very, very, very special country, and I hope you all know how amazing it is where you live and the work that you do. So thank you so very much.
Thank you, Solitaire Townsend.